This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on December 6th. We're still at NDC London, and now we're talking to Rob Ashton, who just came out of a cage match, which was looking at different testing techniques in JavaScript and Node versus .NET, C-sharp, and statically typed languages. What was the general gist of that conversation?
Well, I think the gist is that I won. I would say that first and foremost, definitely. But to be fair, Jeremy had no chance because .NET is... you're fighting an uphill battle to do things the way you want to do them. Mm. And that's unfortunate because it doesn't really matter that it's .NET. It doesn't matter that it's statically typed. That's not a problem. It's just the tooling and the support around that stuff is not good, so you have to basically build it all yourself from scratch, and you are very much fighting the herd. It's unfortunate. Hmm.
So what did you think, though, about what Jeremy did show? Was there anything there that was good?
It's very good. You know, I really like that in the FUBU build chain, for example, they're leveraging things from Ruby, for example. It's a good move. You know, they've got some really good stuff. Why invent it again in C-sharp when that stuff does just fine? Hmm. Unfortunately, it means having to have a Ruby environment on your machine that works. Good luck with that.
But I heard you like Ruby.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Absolutely, yeah. Having spent a few months at a startup writing Ruby and doing Rails, I have to say that community is just... They got so many things wrong, it's unbelievable. But they got a big part of things right as well. And the proof of that is the fact that Fubu guys are using it. Mm. I like how fast it was to bootstrap a new application and how to do end-to-end testing works with it, with an in-memory store, and you can do that really easily and almost declaratively, in fact. And that's really good. My only problem with it is if I want to go and do that tomorrow, that's going to be difficult for me. You know, me personally doing it myself, I'll have a steep learning curve. I'll have to install a big pile of things on my enterprise Windows machine that I'm not used to having on my machine as an enterprise developer. I'm going to learn how to use them. I'm going to have to learn how to use all those tool chains and things that don't work in the same way that you're used to with most Microsoft technologies. And then once I've made that effort and learned how to do that, I'm going to have to persuade my entire team that that's a good idea as well and teach them how to do it. And a lot of effort. And all the while, you know, you've probably got in the enterprise environment a manager breathing down your back asking why the product isn't delivered yet. Mm. And that, again, is unfortunate.
So here's something interesting I thought about during your conversation in there. A lot of people who work in languages like JavaScript and Ruby, quite often when they talk about testing, they say, oh, testing is so easy because we monkey patch things. But you said that you do not like that approach.
I don't like it because it's not explicit. Mm. I don't tend to do very fine-grained tests, and this is one of the things me and Jeremy definitely disagree on. I tend to see very little value in dropping down and testing whether a single function returned the right thing under certain conditions. Certainly not manually anyway. A tool like QuickCheck, maybe I can get away with justifying the overhead of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Can we stop just a second? What is QuickCheck?
QuickCheck is a tool that comes from the Haskell community, which pretty much goes around the idea of specifying a model around your code, saying, for these cases, this should happen. And the model is not a case of here's a set of rows with columns in them with data, give me some output. It's more specifying in terms of some kind of equation almost. Mm. For all strings, when I call this method, I should be able to get this result out of it. And then it will generate a big pile of strings. If it finds any error cases, it'll actually hone down on the smallest possible error case it can. That kind of generative testing offers a really good feedback for the amount of effort you have to put in to do it. Mm. I'm a big fan of that. Where were we before QuickCheck?
Oh, dear.
Monkey patching.
Yeah. So because I don't tend to do very fine-grained testing, I don't need to monkey patch tiny little bits of code I've got. Generally, I have one or two external dependencies in a module that I have. Normally, I write things in modules, and they have a couple of dependencies, and they do a certain thing that offers functionality to my application. For example, I might have a module that has the ability to get ponies and serve them over HTTP to an application or something like that. That's a module.
It's ponies as a service.
Ponies as a service. Pass, yes. I'm taking over that acronym. It's mine now. And I write that as a module, and I've got HTTP endpoints, and I've got, and that adds some routes to an Express application. Maybe that's what it does. And it needs to talk to a database, and maybe optionally, let's say, it has to talk to a file system. Let's say they've got two external dependencies there, the file system and the database. Mm-hmm. The database I might represent as an in-memory map dictionary or map. and the file system, I'll probably create a fake version of the file system that does this one thing and returns the data that I need tests to pass. Most likely, that database construct that I've got, it's something I use across my entire code base as a module again, and it represents a fake database that I can test whether things are going in and out of it quite happily. And because I've only got two external dependencies, I don't mind bootstrapping my entire module by passing them into a function saying, this is your database, please use it. This is a function you can use to go and get data, or a function you can use to put data in.
And so how do you bootstrap your whole application to pass those? You know what I mean? At what point do you inject those things?
So my app.js tends to be two lines of code, which require the app and new the app up. Mm-hmm. And so when I actually run it from the command line, node app.js, it bootstraps sort of a default set of dependencies, like a real database and a real file system and whatever. That's really great. When I want to run this from a test, I'll require the app.js, and I will manually invoke the function that was in the first place and pass in my dependencies at that point. So very much top-down. So the startup, the entry point of my application is basically about newing up various object graphs and passing them into each other. And I say object graphs because actually most of the time it's just functions. Mm-hmm. But dependencies one way or another. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't tend to have very deep dependency chains. Mm-hmm. I find that in container-oriented worlds, you can very much easily accidentally end up with deep object graphs, and then you think that's a problem you need to solve somehow. If you're sticking to small modules that do single, very simple little things, the object graph or the dependency graph remains fairly flat, and passing dependencies around doesn't become much of a problem. It's an opinion that's fairly unpopular in the .NET world, so I'm expressing it here, knowing that everyone's going to be rolling their eyes at me right now, saying, "What's he on about? So you intend to solve all my problems?" And that's fair enough. You know, I'm not going to argue with that because I've left that world a little bit now, and I'm past it. I don't care.
Sure. I mean, you take a very functional approach to things, which, you know, perhaps because you're in JavaScript, that's the primary abstraction, right? Did that lead you to Clojure, or was it vice versa?
No, it didn't. The reason I did Clojure was simply I was at the hipster booth at NDC 2011, and a nice girl called Boda was sat there, and with her Emacs and whatever, and I went, please, show me some functional stuff. Mm. I want to do some Lispy stuff. And I went, I'll use Common Lisp. And she went, no, don't use Common Lisp. Use Clojure. I went, Clojure? What's Clojure? It's this. All they need is the JVM. I went, oh no, not the JVM. Please, anything but the JVM. But it turns out the process wasn't too painful, and once I'd finished downloading the internet via Maven, everything worked quite happily. And the reason I stuck with it is because I went back to London for a little bit this year, and there's a really, really good Clojure community there. So I decided to start going along to it and learn some more things and help out, and that's the reason why I stuck with it, is because the community in London is so good.
What do you like about Clojure?
What do I like about Clojure itself? I don't think it's what I like about Clojure. I think that may be the wrong question. What do I like about functional programming languages is probably a better question, because the essence is very honest about itself and honest about programming. You say, look, everything's data, and behavior over that data. Let's separate those two things. And actually, let's keep our data really flat and simple, and let's express it as either a sequence of things or a map of key value pairs. And let's just do everything with those. Let's keep those very simple constructs and say we have very basic data constructs. If you do that, you can do most of your operations as either maps or reducers over that and get your results fairly easily. And you find when operating in that environment that you bring in the Clojure core libraries, and they end up being pretty much all you need to get all the answers you need. They've got all the basic functional operations in there to operate over these known data structures. And that's that whole adage, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's, you know, better to have 10,000 functions that operate over a single known data structure than to have 10,000 data structures with a single method, with each with single method. You know, that's, I'm not going to start off in a big rally against OO, because most of us don't really do OO anyway. And we conflate so many things and terms around that. But certainly in terms of expressing things as simple data structures and operating over them as sequences, I find that very helpful. And you find that when doing interop with classic Java stuff, the easiest way to use that enclosure is to get it converted into a map or a sequence as early as possible and pass that out to your external application. And then you haven't got to worry about all these crazy data structures that this library is exposing. I really like the idea of it.
And you've been tweeting about a project you've been working on in Clojure, building the database, if it's okay to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it.
What have you learned from it?
Originally, I was learning Clojure by trying to write games, and it turns out it's really hard. I was out of my depth. I had to do something easy, like write a database. I say that half-jokingly. I've been writing, obviously, RavenDB stuff for a while, and it's a domain that's familiar to me, and that's perhaps why it's a good idea.
And you've written a lot of HTML5 games.
A lot. It's one of my... I attend a lot of game jams and write games in 48 hours and ship them and get them done. It's taught me a lot about delivering code and how to maintain a project for that short lifespan, but not get tangled up in huge piles of spaghetti JavaScript. Very useful. Recommend that to anybody. So that's why I tried doing games. But wow, what an awful experience that was, especially ClojureScript. Not good at the time I was using it. So I settled on my database because I've actually had several conversations with Allende about RavenDB's indexing engine and how good that would be if written in a more functional manner with immutable objects. Because one of the problems with that indexing engine often is that you change it and you get odd side effects and bugs occur and you end up spending 8 hours scratching your head as to why the value of X is suddenly not X anymore. It's quite upsetting. Let's try and do that in a functional language. So I decided to re-implement RavenDB effectively in Clojure. So far, I've got quite a lot of functionality, including multi-way replication and master-slave replication and all the indexing and dynamic queries, and I can deal with any arbitrary objects that come from Clojure and pass them through an HTTP API. I've got the in-memory database, the on-disk database, I've got real persistence, I've got the embedded version, the remote version, and it clocks in at about...
It's all
one
done in a weekend.
Yeah.
Clocks in at 1,700 lines of code.
Wow, that's impressive.
And most of that's integration with external libraries.
I was going to say, is the I.O. actually done through the JVM?
It is, yes. Yeah. So you end up taking dependencies on classic Java libraries, and that's where I got that learning about getting things into maps or sequences as early as possible. Mm. Because at first I didn't, and I was just passing all these things around the place, which I had to call strange methods on, and it caused me huge problems. As a learning project, really valuable. I learned an awful lot about how to structure a functional program. Turns out the end result is actually quite tidy as well. I'm not sure what to do with it yet. It's sitting there, it's got a GitHub page, and...
What's it called?
It's called Craven. Yeah, I don't have an imagination for names. I should have done this ask Rob Connery for a name, and he'd given me one out of the box, like, straight away, and I didn't do that. So it's called Craven, and no one seems to mind, and, you know, it only does Clojure, so I'm not competing with Raven at all, because it only deals with Clojure objects, you know, using the Eden protocol, Eden standard. So... it's just a nice little project. I am undecided as to what to do with it. It's just a pile of code that I learned to do things with. I might use it next year to teach Clojure. I might start helping other people do Clojure just because it's given me a lot of joy and put myself in a position where I enjoy writing code again. And I think that there are a lot of other people who are also having issues with their motivation and passion these days because the trudge is the trudge. And I ran an informal dojo yesterday with 8 other .NET developers, and we sat down, each passed the keyboard round and wrote a little program together really quickly, and everyone left with smiles on their faces because it's just fun to play with. And I think sharing that would be kind of nice. So I might use that project to do that because it's very simple and easy to use. It's a nice place to start.
Cool.
When you have to walk away from code for a bit to relax or something, what do you do?
I don't. I just work all the time. No, that's a lie. So the past year, I've been traveling around and working for various companies around the place, and I tend to be doing 1 or 2 week contracts at a time or little consultancy gigs, and I have a lot of spare time. And most of that spare time has been writing Clojure, learning as much as I possibly can in as short a time as possible, really cramming it in, even working for free for some companies just to learn more Clojure. What do I do in my downtime? I don't really have any downtime, but I wish I did. Not having a house makes that difficult. I miss my Xbox, I miss my beanbag, and I think that's the answer right there. I think during my downtime, I really want to play Assassin's Creed 4 or whatever the hell's just come out, and I can't. So I think that's what I'm going to do next year. But that's my downtime. You know, it's cooking, I guess, and gaming. Yep. I do a lot of cooking.
What sort of cooking?
Complicated things.
Like?
So I had a real love affair of curry last year, and I sat there and learned how to make a lot of different curries from scratch and my own little pastes and things like that, and I found that quite interesting. But that was like, that's just everything in a pot cooking, and I moved on from that, and now I'm thinking about, well, actually, I have a piece of meat here. What am I going to do with it? What am I going to serve with it? And I start doing 4 or 5 things at the same time and trying to season everything so they're perfect, so everyone who eats it goes, wow, more of that. And I say, no, you can't have more than that. I gave you just enough that you still want more, but you're fat. And I find getting that right is a joy, you know, and people wait, anymore? No, there's no more. Sorry, it's done. The art is finished.
The opinionated chef.
I love that. It's so much fun. And I guess that's why I like doing code as well. It's like shipping something and giving something to somebody. Difference with cooking is your iteration time is much lower because you can do it once per day if you're lucky. And, you know, you have to learn a lot from doing things once. when, because it's expensive too. You can't sit there and cook filet every single night for 2 months. Actually, I did that. I was in Belgium. I was really bored in Belgium. I had nothing else to do, so it made sense at the time.
Anything exciting coming up in the early 2014?
For who? Me or everyone else?
Anyone.
Well, I'm excited by 2014. I've got my plans already sorted for the first 3 or 4 months. I'm booked up for work and things like that. And I'm taking a full-time job next year doing Erlang. But before that, I'm doing 2 weeks in India and 4 weeks in Thailand. And I'm just going to chill out a little bit before I start putting my head down and building things again. Right. So I miss shipping real products. You know, it's all very well and good writing a big pile of code in my spare time and helping other companies do a little bit of things here, a little bit of thing over there, maybe a feature or two here and there. But I want to sit down and work with a real product again. I'm ready for that. I've had a year off, and I'm ready to just start doing stuff. So it's Erlang away, apparently. Looking forward to that a lot.
Is that something that I imagine you'd be able to take some of your Clojure experience and sort of apply it to that environment?
I'm hoping that's the case. Yes. And I imagine that had I not done that Clojure, I would not be having a job offer for doing Erlang. Yeah. You know, I think that's one of the values of picking up something that you're not really used to doing and rolling with it and learning as much as you possibly can with it. Because while you might not end up working in that one thing, it'll teach you enough that you can go and use that somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, my .NET has changed massively since doing my Java, doing my Clojure, doing everything else, and I think that's a really valuable insight. I like, having realized that it changes the way I write my other codes, I want to go and look at other things as much as possible so I can take those learnings and put them back into other things.
All right, well, thanks, Ralph, for being on the show.
Cool, thank you.